Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd legislative session will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Lee Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Happy Thursday afternoon.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller present.
Representative Novotny.
Representative Novotny is having issues. He's trying to get logged in.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Shong. Representative Shong.
How about this? I'm here. Can you hear me now?
Perfect. Thank you. And that concludes roll call.
Very well, thank you, Abdul. A quorum is present, and we will certainly look out for Representative Botany as he comes in. I had a good meeting with him this morning, so I know he's working hard today. This hearing is being conducted under the Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing members to debate and vote by means of distant voting, remote electronic voting, or other means to allow legislative operations while preserving the safety of the public, staff, and members. The hearing may be viewed on the via the House webcast. The link is on the committee website page. On that page, you will also find email in which those interested in testifying can contact our committee administrator, Jamel Lunday, 24 hours before a hearing. Members, we've got three items today, but they're beefy items. And so we're going to have a busy conversation debate today. I look forward to that. We have a review of the Peace Officer Standards and Training Pulse Board. We have our Pulse Board Executive Director, Eric Missel, to take us through sort of a review of where we've been in interacting with the Pulse Board over the past 3 years and some of the big changes and movements that they have been about. And then we're also going to hear Representative Hollins, House File 3398, no-knock search warrant process requirements modified. Of course, recent events have really lifted that issue as a primary issue of importance for us. And then we'll also be concluding the House File 3120, Representative Miller, Labor Trafficking and Exploitation Working Group established. But at this point, I would look for a motion from our vice chair to adopt the minutes of February 15th.
So moved, Chair.
Very well. Representative Frazier moves adoption of the February 15th minutes discussion. Let me get my hands up view here as well. Okay, very well. I don't see any hands up. Representative Johnson, voice vote will suffice.
If you can hear me, that'll be fine.
we can't hear you, sir. Very well.
I will have to leave my video off. I'm having you're cutting in and out.
Understood. That often happens to many of us here. So with that, members, all in favor of the Frazier motion to adopt the February 15th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the February 15th minutes of this committee are hereby adopted. Members, the chair will pull up House File 3120 first in our discussion, so that we can quickly move past that and then spend our time with the the issues that we have yet to debate. As you'll recall, we heard this bill last week, had some debate on it. The author at that time took very careful notes and recognized some of the issues that were being raised, which are quite frankly more appropriate in the other committees that have direct jurisdiction over this bill. And so he will be acting on those at that time. And so the chair's intent is to quickly hear from the author, quickly hear any last comments from committee members, and then move very expeditiously, quickly to a vote. So with that, Representative Frazier, if you would be so kind as to move House File 3120 be referred to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. We'll greatly appreciate it.
So moved, Chair.
Very well. The motion is before us. Representative Miller, I trust you are with us. Tell us very quickly and briefly, just remind us what this bill entails.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I know you have a heavy docket, so I'll be brief, but I appreciate your time that you're giving me here today. This is the work group to address labor trafficking in the state of Minnesota. We had good testimony, and I will be, I know it's brief here, but I'll be more than happy to talk with anyone offline after this. What the chair referenced is there were a couple kind of technical corrections in an amendment that we want to move. And then I took to heart what Lee Johnson had said about tightening up. Some other people had commented there's some language tightening up, but also the size of the work group. So I'm just going to dance very quickly, I promise you, very quickly through, just so that they're understanding. We did switch the Human Services to Department of Health. That gets it in line with what we intended to do. And then the working group is down to 12 members plus the working group, and they're defined as individual people. So it's one survivor of labor trafficking exploitation, one safe harbor service provider, one representative of Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Commissioner of Health or designee, Commissioner of Labor designee, Commerce, Human Rights, Human Services, Office of the Attorney General, Tribal Government, Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and Board of Public Defense, one from each of those. And really, there are some other people that we do have included in the language of the amendment that is really just to identify that in committees, we're going to be bringing some other people into that. But I agree totally with Lee Johnson that an unwieldy committee does not get things accomplished. And that's certainly what we do. And just to reiterate, and then I'll be done, Mr. Chair, the purpose of this working group is because of the complex nature of this, it's difficult to just write legislation. We did this 10 years ago with the Safe Harbor No Wrong Door, and it worked well. A couple of years ago, Representative Moeller and I brought forward something on sexual assault, and that working group is doing good work. So we have a level of confidence that this is going to be real work, and members of this committee, I ask for your support.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Miller. We certainly will be watching as the bill, assuming it moves forward in this committee, action on the amended language, which I do think is better appropriated, or rather better assigned to a committee with direct jurisdiction. But you've listened very carefully to members' concerns, and I greatly appreciate that. Representative Johnson, I'll turn to you quickly, and then we'll move to a vote.
I want to, Chair Mariani, Representative Miller, thank you for doing some of those changes. I believe this bill has a long ways to go, going through some, not only in committees, but to make this actually workable and understandable. I know I was doing some checking, and over the past couple years, there's been from 2017, 2018, 19 and 20, we had some issues that did pop up as far as workforce, issues dealing with something that might be covered under this bill. Before that, they were non-reported to the State Human Trafficking Committee. While there was a lot of human trafficking, very little or nothing involved workforce types issues until 19 there was 10, 20 there was 13. I'm just wondering if you could, if I remember right, the sex trafficking task force is also looking in at these as well. I'm just wondering if you could explain why we need a separate one and that we couldn't have the current human trafficking, which is the same as workforce sector, labor trafficking, because a lot of times they overlap, couldn't be doing the same thing, and why we need a separate task force to do this.
That's a very good question, and Representative Muller, if you can be extremely brief, I'd greatly
appreciate it. Yeah, absolutely. Representative Johnson, Ms. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's really the crux of the question there, so I appreciate you bringing it up. I've been very involved in the sex trafficking, anti-sex trafficking, I guess I should say, work. And as we move forward with that, labor trafficking has come forward a couple times and asked really just exactly what you have said. The problem is the intricate nature of this, and I believe Representative Pinto is probably going to enforce this with his work that he does in the civilian side, is the sex trafficking has very distinct principles about it that I won't get into at length here, but basically they are about literally moving people, moving fast, identifying it, moving it quick, treating these victims as victims instead of as criminals. That's a little bit different than the nature of labor trafficking, which is usually more deep investigation. It takes more time. It is, they identify that you either have an employer of many employees or just a single person that they're employing under false circumstances. It just takes a different angle, a different dive. When we've talked with the BCA and we've talked with other organizations that are in the trafficking world, they do agree that we need to have a different lane for this. If we're going to address it in the state of Minnesota, and I really think that this task force, this working group, is going to be the thing that helps really meet that out and allow us to address this properly.
Very well. Representative Pinto, I believe to this point, I saw you nodding your head very briefly, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I would agree. We've had a huge focus in our state on sex trafficking. It's time to take the next step on labor trafficking. That's exactly what this bill does. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very important distinction, so I do appreciate the question from Representative Johnson. Members, Representative Fraser renews his motion that House File 3120 be referred to the Committee on Human Services, Finance, and Policy. Representative Miller, that sounds correct. Okay, very well. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Lee Johnson? Lee Johnson?
Yes.
Lee Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, aye. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
Lucero, yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, yes. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, yes.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Shung?
Aye.
Representative Shung, aye. And that concludes roll call with 19 ayes and 0 nays.
Very well. With 19 ayes and 0 nays, House File 3120, the motion prevails in House File 3120 is referred to the Committee on Human Services, Finance and Policy. Representative Miller, thank you for a good bill. Thank you for listening to the committee members. And members, thank you for expressing a very strong statement out of this committee about the seriousness of labor trafficking and our intent to end it, minimize it, curb it in our state. Well, good luck, Representative Miller. Good bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Members, next we're going to have a presentation from the Peace Officer Standard and Training Board. Executive Director Eric Missel will lead that presentation. We do have the Board Chair, Chief Kelly McCarthy, here available for questions. It is my intent to hear this presentation, per what I mentioned at the beginning of the hearing, and then open up for comments and discussion. However, I will be moving at 1:45 p.m. sharply onto House File 3398 so that we can have adequate time to talk about the no-knock search warrant bill. So with that, members, I'll call forward. Always good to welcome our Pulse Board Executive Director, Director Eric Missel. Please come forward, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to address the progress that we've made here at POST over the last couple of years since I became executive director in January of 2020, and Chief McCarthy has served as the new board chair. I did notice that you received a pretty good overview of the POST board and its mission at this committee's hearing this past Tuesday. So as a result, I'm going to not waste your time revisiting that information, although I certainly can address any questions that may have arisen out of that presentation from a practitioner standpoint, if there are any. So today I'm going to focus my presentation on post board activities over the last 2 years, and as well as various initiatives that are ongoing or planned. And I'm going to start out with talking about pre-service education. One of the things that I had set as a goal early on was to complete an updated job task analysis of the police officer position. It had not been done since 2015. So that was completed in 2021. And we will be using that to identify learning objectives that are missing from our current curriculum for pre-service education, to make adjustments to learning objectives to keep them current with the profession, of course, and then to eliminate learning objectives that are no longer relevant or critical. And then, of course, update the peace officer examination, which linked to this, we will be doing here in the next couple of months. Our licensing coordinator did just retire, so we'll be hiring a new one and then undertaking that project. Also in pre-service, we recertified the 30 PPOE school providers. And I apologize for those who are not familiar with that acronym, Professional Peace Officer Education is PPOE. And then we'll likely move to a 3-year recertification cycle going forward versus the 5-year we currently use now. And that was one of the recommendations that came out of our IAD list audit. We've regularly updated the peace officer exam, but again, we're setting up for a more comprehensive overhaul of the exam in 2022 here. We completed an RFP and awarded a new contract to both develop the exam and deliver the post-exam. In addition to greater efficiency, this will allow POST to give better feedback and data to individual candidates, as well as the PPOE schools with regard to their success and the success of their students on the post-exam, something that was a bit lacking under our older system. So, in the very near future, one of the major projects in terms of pre-service that is, it's very large, very complex, but will be starting is to review current peace officer education as a whole, both the process and the content. And the intent here is to standardize pre-service education across the state. Right now, and I know we've talked about in this committee, and I've certainly talked with some individual representatives from this committee about the variation, if you will, across the state in pre-service education. So again, as was pointed out in the IAD list audit, we're going to work to standardize that. This will make the system more efficient for candidates, so they know exactly whether they go to this school or that school, that they're going to get the same education, the same information. And it's going to allow, in my view, more candidates from non-traditional backgrounds to see policing as a viable option. And I won't go down into the weeds on how that happens, but I do think that will be an end result, which, as we've seen already in this session, is a large concern at the state level, is trying to get enough folks interested in policing and give them an opportunity to get into the pipeline, so to speak. Switching to regulatory functions, I just want to say that many of the issues regarding post and its regulatory roles and authority arise out of rule and statute. And I know most of the members of this committee are aware of that. And certainly after Tuesday, you heard that as well. But since its creation in 1977, the board's operated for many decades, as it was expected to by the legislature, various governors and stakeholders over the years. Literally, I can say, having been started here in 2017 and then taking over the director's role in 2020, it's literally only been in the last 2 years that expectations of the board in terms of peace officer education, licensing, and certainly regulation have significantly changed. I don't need to tell this body that legislation is time-consuming and by definition rife with politics, making it a creature of consensus unless one group or another has unilateral power, which we do not have in the state of Minnesota. Arguably, rulemaking is even more cumbersome than time-consuming, especially when there is no expectation that such rules needed change over the years, which obviously has changed. So with that as a preface, some of the things that we are tackling or have tackled over in terms of regulatory functions involve background investigations. We are developing specific requirements for background investigations. It's being developed at the Rules Advisory Committee meetings. And part of that process in our overhaul of rules. You're going to hear that a lot from me throughout this presentation because they are, in fact, tackling a lot of the issues that have been identified over the past couple of years. Internally, we've already implemented that our post staff, our standards coordinators, are now reviewing completed background investigations when we are conducting agency compliance reviews. So we are looking through those backgrounds. And even absent a clear direction from statute regarding what those backgrounds should be, we are vetting those and providing feedback where they may be lacking or anything along those lines in terms of offering some best practices ideas. In terms of compliance reviews specifically, with COVID subsiding, finally, we hope, we caught up with our compliance reviews that were due in 2020 and then completed all that were scheduled in 2021. So we're getting back to a more robust speed, if you will, in terms of doing our compliance reviews. And part of that, I will say, too, is in thanks to the legislature for providing us with that third position for in standards coordination. We have just recently become issuing subpoenas and post-investigations. This is something that I have issued a couple subpoenas and recently for records, administrative subpoenas for records, as allowed under Statute 214.10. To my knowledge, this authority has never been used by post in the past. And as in addition to that, I'm seeking some additional legislation potentially this session to increase data sharing when we are conducting investigations. So I can talk about that further if necessary. We deployed the misconduct reporting database that I know Chair Mariani was a main author behind this bill that was passed. That was required deployed, and we've conducted training and continue work with the vendor to build our reporting capabilities. CLIOs are now required to report the alleged violations of standards of conduct or model policies. And I just want to point out that this was a May report proposition before, under rule until the statute was passed. Speaking of the data sharing statute with regard to investigations, I'm seeking creation of that statute that would require and allow local agencies and officials to provide private investigatory data to post upon notification that we've opened an investigation into alleged misconduct. We do run into that issue now where other boards have data sharing statutes. Post does not, and I'm looking to get that addressed through legislation. And finally, we are maintaining information on all complaints that are submitted to the board. As I think most on this committee know, much of that, unless there is final discipline, remains private. However, we are maintaining those records for historical purposes, whether or not they result in discipline. In the past, dismissed complaints were destroyed. Switching to rules and policy, the entire rule chapter is under review for updating, as I think you all know. We had a rules advisory committee, which is made up of members of the community, law enforcement, broad spectrum of stakeholders that are working very hard. Have had multiple meetings to work on our rules. Work is substantially completed. I can report on rules for background investigations, psychological screening, minimum selection standards, and standards of conduct. These rules and the advisory committee report on proposed rules will be going to the full board at the April meeting. If approved, the next steps for rulemaking, which follows state statute section 14, will be this spring and early summer. The board will seek the governor's approval, publish a draft for public comment, and notify all legislative committees. Then late summer or fall, we anticipate holding a public hearing in fall of 2022, and go to the Office of Administrative Hearings to review the rules as proposed. And then late fall to early winter 23, assuming we have the OAH approval, adopt and implement in late fall 2022 or early 23, at which point another phase of rulemaking will take place where we'll continue to work on amending rules in other areas such as continuing education, PPOE, and et cetera. Policy work. So First Amendment right protection reform that was brought up during the last session and through our advisory council. The board did adopt a model policy regarding public assembly and identified best practices at its July 22nd, 2021 meeting. Additional discussion is taking place at the Rules Advisory Committee as well in terms of making this model policy mandated. It is currently just a best practices policy. As you, I'm sure, know, policies are only mandatory through either legislation or rulemaking. Duty to report theft. Licenses are currently required to report this and other violation standards of conduct. And again, as I mentioned before, CLIOS must report this offense and others as a result of passage of 66.8457. Addition to the post standards of conduct and reporting requirements for licensees are being discussed also at the Rules Committee, Rules Advisory Committee of the Board. License sanctions for use of excessive force. I know this was discussed partially on Tuesday with regard to the case out of Minneapolis. Post rules currently allow licensing sanctions for violations of the deadly force statute, and the inclusion of the excessive force or the use of force statute, not just deadly force, which is 609.06, is being discussed at the Rules Advisory Committee level. Again, I mentioned I'm going to be mentioning them a lot. Duty to intercede was adopted by the board in the mandatory model policy on use of force and adopted by all law enforcement agencies across the state. And again, the duty to intercede for excessive force will be part of that larger discussion regarding incorporating the 609.06 into our rules. And then one of the other concerns or policy decisions was made regarding duty of law enforcement officer, chief law enforcement officer to act on complaints. The implementation, of course, of the new misconduct reporting requirement allows promulgation of public reports of summary data once the data has been collected by the system. So when we get to the point of having enough data and then producing that public report, it'll be a better picture in terms of summary data as to which agencies are reporting what. Most importantly in this area, and I think from a transparency standpoint, is I am in the process currently of completing an RFP to seek a vendor to create and deploy a publicly facing dashboard that will allow members of the public to access all data that is classified as public on all licensees, including final disciplinary documentation. This would be modeled after the Board of Nursing's interface functionality. If you've been on there, you know what you can do with that. It gets easy access to all public data, and it's something that we have a goal to complete here at the Post Board. This does require supplemental budget requests, which did make it into the governor's supplemental budget. So I'm appreciative of that, and hopefully we'll pass muster as the process goes forward. And a final change in terms of policy and rules, the change of standards of conduct violations to not require a criminal conviction, which is, I think, as this committee is well acquainted, that is currently the case with POST. This is being addressed through the rulemaking process. There's broad correlation to other discussions regarding modifications to standards of conduct. So ongoing takes time. I think I've made that point. Just to give you a quick idea, and then I will wrap up. Summary of, I just want to talk about the increase in number of meetings that the board has had in additional subcommittees and special committees have been created to take action on many of the items that have been brought forward. In 2020, we had a grand total of 25 meetings. That would be everything, all the complaint committee, the board, everything else. 2021, we went to 48, almost doubled. And then in 2022 so far, second week in February, we already have 10 on board. So there's a lot of activity, a lot of things going on. And I would just say that if it seems like there's been a lot of work and activity, that's because there has been. As I referenced earlier, the board recognizes the expectations have changed, and they've changed very quickly. There are many complex issues that involving reform and focusing on best practices in the policing profession. No one can change philosophy, public policy, procedure, or structure regarding an entire profession overnight. This is true even if there's broad agreement among all constituencies, which, as we all know, there is not, as to what is lacking or how to change it. And I think it is somewhat unrealistic to expect that the Post Board or any other regulatory agency for that matter can update all the rules, business processes, legislation, et cetera, necessary in 2 years after nearly 40 years of little to no change being asked of or required. So, and I say that just to ask, and I think I do, I think this committee and others have been very, have worked very well with myself and the chair and the board, but just to say that there is a lot of work going on here and it's gonna take time. And we appreciate your patience and understanding in that regard. With that, I conclude my presentation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Misselt. Certainly a lot of work. And I do note, and we heard that from the independent researcher the other day, Dr. Panamarenko, echoing what you just shared, you know, which is 40 years, a little to no change on this board and its work. And yet, all the research, all the common sense tells us that in order to have a meaningful, owned, effective public safety system, it's important to have public trust. And in order to have public trust, we really do need this board to not, you know, wait another 40 years, you know, to modernize, you know, the profession and how we approach it, what we expect of it, and to do that in a very transparent manner. So a rigorous, you know, professional approach here is absolutely appreciated, and this committee has strongly supported that. And, you know that our door is always open in terms of what resources, if it comes down to a matter of resources, the Post would require. Just a few things very quickly, and then we have three questioners. One is that In the last legislative session, as you know, we did some statutory changes to the training fund. One of the things that we did was rename it the Philando Castile Training Fund. And it was certainly my intention throughout the entire process to make sure that we not just only changed the name of the fund, but to make sure that the fund consistent with that change, in order to honor that those resources were absolutely focused on what created that fund in the first place, which was to have a clear use for crisis response, for conflict management, for cultural diversity, professional attainment on the part of our licensed peace officers, and to address autism issues specifically. And so I would ask you to get back to me in terms of, I would ask you to review and provide me advice on whether or not the language we provided this last session gives you very clear and the board very clear, ability to focus on those elements for the fund. And then I do want to lift up, your comment on, or sharing rather, on the public-facing dashboard. I too am pleased to see that in the supplemental budget request. This again goes to the issue of trust. It does deal with data that is already, exclusively, not primarily, or primarily if not exclusively, available at the local level. It has been for a long time. But I just want to really highlight the importance of that, because it does go to the public trust, which is so important for public safety. And then the final thing I'll just throw in, and I'll turn to questions here, is that the policy work that the board has taken on is absolutely to be applauded and encouraged. I want to make sure that we don't lose the pace, that we keep a strong and rigorous pace relative to that work. And you shared some of the policy work that you're currently engaged in. I think it's critically important, and I understand you want to be very careful about it, but I also think it's important to balance that off with that huge need and desire to constantly keep the public's trust in this licensed, important, critical function of our government. And in order to do that, the public really does need to see constant movement. Not super slow walking movement. I will certainly work with you and the board to help explain to the public the need to be, professionally appropriate in terms of the pace, but I also want to make sure it's a strong pace. With that, I'm going to turn to First Representative Hollins for your question and or comments. Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Chair. I really appreciate this conversation today. I was actually just on a panel last night talking about our post board and the work that we're doing and trying to make sure that it is being responsive to the needs of the community. And I think, I think we're headed in the right direction, and I'm really happy to see movement at the board. I am slightly concerned about how long it's taking and how long it has taken. And so with that in mind, I just want to ask if there's a reason why there haven't been a request for more funding for staff increases. I think, as we see this sort of overhaul of the rules, I'm guessing that there's going to need to be more staff there in order to ensure compliance. And I think that's something that our committee and the legislature in general would be pretty enthusiastic about supporting for the most part. And so I was wondering if there is going to be an increase in staffing and if you're going to be asking for some funding to make that happen.
Director Messel.
Thank you for that question. And maybe this is this goes back to my old days when I was routinely called out on the carpet for budget moves as a municipal agency. You know, certainly the board, and I think I can speak for the board, certainly as the person who has to manage operations, I typically do not ask for funding unless I believe that I can justify and give you good reasons why you should give that to us. And that's part of this, the complexity of this entire issue is that, you know, if we are not, you know, when we talk about, I know ad nauseum on this committee, if we don't have the ability or we're not doing investigations, and there's a lot of debate about whether we should and what extent and how deep do we go, you know, I have a hard time saying, yeah, I'd like four or five positions and not know that there's going to be the workload there. So there are a lot of philosophical and also, I think, public policy questions have to be answered yet. Now, don't get me wrong. You want to hand money and positions. You know, I'd be a fool to say no. But by the same token, you know, I just feel like, as we have done, and I reached out, of course, on the technology end and supplemental budget requests, and I've tried to do some of those things. Those are things that I can do right now. I know they're within our purview and things we can do. And I will ask for those funds as appropriate. And again, with regard to compliance reviews and other issues such as that, as we get a better sense of what the workload's going to look like, then I can appropriately give a reliable data-driven answer or question, I guess, for money and positions. I hope that makes sense. I kind of got, you know.
No, I greatly appreciate that. I do think the compliance work is, and for any agency, is always critically important. And Representative Hollins, I think, is echoing my offer as well to be your partner in terms of making sure that resources don't get in the way of just vitally important work, particularly our compliance work. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Missel, that was an important presentation, and it represents a lot of the work and the progress that's going on at the Post Board. But I got to tell you, I am thankful for your work and leadership of Chair McCarthy. We talk often. I understand. I think you're on the right side of trying to worry, trying to push the Post Board. But the truth is, I am extremely frustrated by our treatment of the constitutional crisis of unaccountable law enforcement. I mean, since the death of George Floyd, we've seen the deaths of Dalo E, Dante Wright, Winston Smith, and most recently, Amir Locke. We've also seen the state, both the legislature and the executive branch, and boards turn itself inside out in order to act quickly for COVID emergency protocols. And I got to tell you, when I talk to constituents and I talk to community members, seeing how government can immediately react to the emergency of COVID, it gives me a window into the frustration of their frustration when it's taken us 2 years to be able to act on a civil licensure without criminal process. And what I believe the legislator initially intended for the Post Board, every other licensing board in the state works that way. Yet those officers that are sworn to protect have this narrow possibility to address their licensure issues. If I'm seeing constitutional rights being violated left and right, and I'm seeing our state take 2 years to rein in those violations or make those violations licensure violations, I would absolutely feel like our inability to act is an indictment of us who swore a duty to protect the Constitution. In 2017, this legislator totally revamped the teacher licensing board. And I often talk about the teachers because I work close with education, but they totally revamped. They dissolved the board of teaching, created a new licensing board because they believed and they listened to complaints around that licensing board. So I think our actions here, the slow walk that we're taking to get this done, is totally unacceptable. We have a crisis at hand. We took action for teachers. And are we saying we can't take action to make sure that we have a high level of standards and accountability for our law enforcement officers? I know it will build trust and confidence within our communities if we do that. And I'm imploring you to do whatever you can with your board to make sure it happens as quick as possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fraser. And as someone who was part of that effort a few years ago with the teacher board, that was a bipartisan effort. I worked very closely with Chair Erickson at the time, precisely for some of the reasons you just listed, because it's really important. Very few things are very more important than the constitutional rights that lie at the heart of why we have a standards-based police licensing structure in this state. And so, very good counsel indeed. Representative Johnson, and then we're going to move. I'm violating my own advice to move, but I want to make sure we get your voice in. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Director Missel, thanks for being here today. I do have some concerns of what's going on in the law enforcement field. As far as the number of officers available to be hired and a few other issues, what I'm wondering is the number of peace officers that are actually taking the exam is going down. It's gone down last year dramatically from the year before. And overall, since 2016, it's down about 20%. We currently have roughly 800 to 1,000 openings for peace officers across the state at this time. In September of 2021, KSTP-TV did a story. Minneapolis, at that time, wanted to hire 49 recruits, but they were only able to get 26 applicants for those 49 openings. So recruiting is difficult. I know a jurisdiction in my district, they had to post the advertisement for the open position for a peace officer three times to get two applicants. When you have that few of applicants, you do not get the best out there. In fact, a lot of these, they can't even fill all the positions that they have. And I'm also hearing that in the college and our technical college system, those going into the law enforcement field and the training in our higher educational system is down 27%. Now we have probably 2,500 officers on top of that, on top of our normal retirement that we have every year, in the next 2 to 3 years are going to be retiring. Do you see any way possible that we're going to fill those open positions with the number of people we have going through the course? And what plans does Post Board have to try to get people into this profession? Because it's a serious issue.
It is an important issue. And Director Messel, perhaps you can share with us what role the Post Board does or could play with that. And then, members, we are going to move forward with the next bill. Director Missel.
Okay, thank you. As I think I've mentioned before, the problem with getting enough officers really runs across the spectrum, private and public. I do think that, just to get directly to your question, Representative Johnson, I do think there are things that we can do and to try and help at least streamline the process. And as I mentioned, the pre-service work we're doing, I'd like to see, and my plan is to work on a development of a system similar to Pathways, for example, for lack of a better term, because I think many people are familiar with that, where someone can come in with a degree unrelated to law enforcement, and in very short order, we can get them up to speed and to the point where they can take the exam and become licensed. I think that's one of the things. Our system right now is very convoluted and inefficient, depends on which school you talk to and so on. So that's probably one of the main areas where POST can be of help in terms of all the other dynamics that are at work, keeping people from going, being available or applying. That's a larger question, probably beyond us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Director Missel. Thank you for the question. Members, this will not be the last time that this important issue is talked about in this committee. We do have some hearings coming up soon, where we're going to spend much more time on this issue.
Chair Murray, I may make at least one more comment.
Well, very quickly, Representative Johnson, please. Thank you.
I just wanted to remind this committee. In 2018, the Princeton University professor, Stephen Mello, analyzed 10 years of data. And he found out fewer peace officers patrolling the streets and keeping our city safe result in more crime. So it is an issue. We're short officers, big time. The pathways, I understand it, but I have concerns on that. Some of the officers that we've had a lot of problems with have been through that program. They don't understand the laws completely. They don't understand the Constitution completely. It's a lot different going through a 2 to 4 year course dealing just with criminal justice than having a degree in something else and coming into it. Having worked the field, I see the huge difference in the officers through that program compared to those. And one thing you have to remember, you also have to remember, your education starts your first day on the job. And that's how to use the education.
We are going to move forward. The purpose of this conversation was to have a review of the current work of the Pulse Board, and I think we're hearing from a number of members the need to maintain an urgency around moving forward with that work. We will come back to this particular issue, though, in a hearing coming up shortly. Director Missel, thank you both for your work, but also thank you for your testimony here today. With that, Representative Hollins moves House File 3398 be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Hollins, your bill is before us.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And thank you, fellow members of the Public Safety Committee. Today, on the day of Amir Locke's funeral, I want us all to recognize that we all have some blood on our hands. I was before this committee last session with a different no-knock warrant ban bill, and we allowed it to be watered down and to be weakened until the point where this could happen again. We were told last year that Minnesota is not Kentucky and that this wouldn't happen in Minnesota. And yet here we are. I am culpable. We are all a little culpable. But today I'm offering us an opportunity for some redemption. House File 3398 is a bill that will ensure that there will never be another Amir Locke. No matter what you think about race or systemic oppression, you can't argue that this bill would have any effect other than keeping our communities and our officers safe. No-knock warrants are a dangerous tool that should only be used in cases where a captive individual may be severely harmed or killed as a consequence of police announcing themselves. Since the killing of Amir Locke, I have spent countless hours working with activists, nonprofits, colleagues, and law enforcement to create a bill that can be agreed upon and make a significant difference. Again and again, I was told by community members that they wanted a complete ban on this dangerous tool. However, stakeholders did agree that there were situations where there's an active, significant harm occurring, it would be appropriate for law enforcement to enter without a notice. So we took that feedback and used it to draft House File 3398, which prohibits the use of no-knock warrants in all but the most narrowly tailored exceptions. The bill also creates systemic change around the application and training for no-knock warrants and creates a consistent process and expectation for the entire state of Minnesota. I want to note really quickly that we would not be the first state to ban no-knock warrants. There are several states who have already done this. And in fact, Florida banned no-knock warrants in 1994. Many other municipalities have banned no-knock warrants, and the world hasn't ended for those cities and municipalities. They are still functioning. They are still around. This is but one of many tools that law enforcement has in order to fight crime. We are hearing from communities. They want us to pass this bill now. And by the way, it's not just folks in Minneapolis or St. Paul. I've heard from people all across Minnesota who want to feel safe and secure in their homes without the state literally breaking down their door with no warning. I first want to invite our nonpartisan research staffer, Jeff Diebel, to walk us through the language. And then I have several testifiers to this bill.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Hollins. I believe we have Mr. Diebel then that can walk us through the bill. I think that's our House research person assigned to this. I want to ask Mr. Diebel to come forward and do that quickly for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Diebel, House Research. House File 3398, on page one, subdivision one, there's no change. Subdivision two is the definition of no-knock warrant. It makes some changes in that definition. Subdivision three adds the substance of the bill. And the first piece, paragraph A, requires the Commissioner of Public Safety to create a standardized no-knock warrant application form for all agencies to use in the state. Paragraph B is the limitation that Representative Hollins mentioned, and it is would limit the use of no-knock warrants to situations where a person is held against their will and there is a significant, articulable, and imminent risk of death or great bodily harm if police cannot enter unannounced. Paragraph C makes conforming changes to the documents that will be required or are required currently. Paragraph D would identify as the substance of the information that must be contained in the documents required under paragraph C, and the only change there is a clarification regarding what conditions prevent execution of the warrant through an announced process. The current paragraph D is stricken under the bill, and that was a limitation on using no-knock warrants when it was only related to a drug possession offense. Paragraph F is a further limitation on the no-knock warrant, which would prevent them their use if the applicant for the warrant knows that someone is handicapped under the federal definition of provided in the bill. Paragraph G prevents the states that if the applicant uses false information to secure a warrant, no-knock warrant, that any evidence obtained is excluded from judicial proceedings. Paragraph H is a new paragraph that would punish peace officers for knowingly using false information to secure no-knock warrants. Moving to page three, the new paragraph subdivision 3A requires the Attorney General, in consultation with the Commissioner of Public Safety, to provide quarterly training to peace officers on search, seizure, and the process of obtaining and executing search warrants. Paragraph B of subdivision 3A states that peace officers must have gone through this training if they seek to participate in execution of a no-knock warrant. Subdivision 4 states that reports that are required from the agencies who use no-knock warrants to the Commissioner of Public Safety are public data. Moving to section 2 of the bill, this directs the post board to develop a model policy and learning objectives on search, seizure, and warrant application and execution. Paragraph B of that subdivision 1 requires chiefs of police and sheriffs to adopt model policy or something similar to that for their agencies. And then finally, subdivision 2 of section 2 requires in-service training on these learning objectives that the post board creates on search, seizure, and warrant application and execution. Mr. Chair, that concludes my overview of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. My gratitude to you and your colleagues for the work that you always do in terms of putting together some very complex ideas into a meaningful a structure for us to debate. With that, members, we're going to hear, I believe Representative Hollins, I can move on to some of the testifiers here. Very well.
Yes.
We're going to hear, and I'm going to ask the testifiers to be as efficient and as concise, but obviously as powerful as you can be. With that, I'm going to ask, I'll call forward Ms. Michelle Gross, Communities United Against Police Brutality, and after her, I'll call forward Mr. Johnson. Michelle Gross, please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony. And are you muted, perhaps?
Oh, my apologies for that.
Quite all right. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Mariani, Arthur Hollins, and members, my name is Michelle Gross, and I'm the president of Communities United Against Police Brutality. Our organization works for police accountability and for professional constitutional policing. I'm here today to talk about no-knock warrants. No-knock warrants are a relic of Nixon's failed war on drugs. That time period led to the development of the kind of militarized policing that is constitutionally questionable, and has driven a wedge between law enforcement and the community. Since that time, many things have changed. In particular, legal gun ownership has increased substantially. At this point, 42.8% of households in Minnesota have at least one legally owned firearm. The Fourth Amendment makes it clear that we have a constitutional right to the highest level of privacy in our homes. And further, the Castle Doctrine outlines the right to defend ourselves in our homes. Thus, the mere presence of a firearm in the home can no longer be the justification for a no-knock warrant. No-knock warrants should be a tactic of last resort and thus exceedingly rare. However, data collected as a result of last year's legislation shows they aren't. Data has just started to be collected in September of last year, and since then, also since agencies have 3 months to report their information, the data are incomplete. Still, since September, a report by the BCA shows that Minnesota courts signed 71 no-knock warrant applications. Of those, 49 were actually executed as no-knock warrants. The limited data shows a racially disparate impact of no-knock warrants. While Black people are 7% of our state's population, they were the subject of 70% of no-knock warrants executed in these few months. Most no-knock warrants were for weapons or drug-related offenses, but have been used to search for such things as stolen gift cards and even a stolen puppy. Faris Hussein purchased a gift card at a reduced rate on eBay. Perhaps he should have known better, but the gift card turned out to be stolen. After he used the card to purchase a snowblower, police used a no-knock warrant to raid his home. Faris and his 9-month pregnant wife, Sarah, were home at the time. Thinking they were under attack by criminals, Faris used his legally owned firearm to shoot through the wall next to the door of his home. Fortunately, no one was injured, but Faris had to hire an attorney to successfully fight charges of assault on a police officer. Faris and his wife were both arrested. Sarah went into labor at the Hennepin County Jail and gave birth to their first child while in shackles. We attempted last session to put some guardrails around no-knock warrants, but even those modest efforts were resisted. House File 3398 addresses the deficiencies in last year's legislation by adding the requirement for a post-board model policy and training and limits the use of this dangerous tactic to only those instances where the element of surprise is absolutely necessary. Hamline Law Professor Joseph E. Olson, an expert on the Second Amendment and author of the Minnesota Conceal and Carry Statute, wrote the following about the Minneapolis police killing of Amir Locke. Quote, "I just listened to the body cam video on my large stereo. Whatever the police were saying, not shouting, is unintelligible gibberish and not even close to police search warrant. No sleeping person can be expected to understand a word said by 6 or 8 voices. I knew what the police said that the team members were supposed to be saying, but I understood not a word. Police on a vest is not readily visible when a high lumen light is shined in a person's dilated pupils and the men in black and blue are hidden in the dark behind the lights. The MPD could not have set up the deceased victim better if they had tried. Remember the time from the kick of the couch to wake him to the shots was not 9 seconds, but less than 2. Can you become fully conscious in 2 seconds? The SWAT team forgot if they ever knew that the purpose of the Fourth Amendment's knock, not done, and announce, done but with gibberish, is to give the subject a realistic chance to understand what is happening and respond appropriately. It is not to disorient and confuse. That is the unconstitutional goal of the conventional SWAT approach, and it causes unnecessary killings, as it did here. Our organization urges passage of House File 3398 as written. We oppose amendments A3 and A5, as well as any other amendments that would weaken this essential life-saving legislation. And I thank you today for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Grill. Some members, we're going to hold off. I do see some hands up, but I'm going to hold off until I get through a number of the testifiers here today. And by the way, Ms. Grill, just very quickly, it was an excellent testimony, but I do think there is bipartisan complicity, if you will. You know, the war on drugs that you listed, rests pretty heavily on the Democratic president's war on crime. Failed initiatives, Lyndon B. Johnson, coming from the late 60s. So there's plenty of things for us to be sharing across the political divide. With that, I'm going to ask, see if Mr. Marvin Johnson is here. I see Mr. Johnson as an impacted person. If you are, please come forward, state your name for the record, and be as brief as you can. Please, sir, come forward. You might be muted. And actually, I'm not seeing. I'm scrolling quickly. So let's keep pushing forward. Rob Doerr, the Gun Owners Caucus. Always good to see you. Come forward, sir. State your name for the record and give us your testimony.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I believe Rob Doerr is still at Amir Locke's funeral.
Oh, okay. All right.
So he thought he would be able to get on, but
yeah, got it.
We can go to Chief McCarthy if that's okay.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Representative. Chief McCarthy, Mendota Heights Chief of Police Department, please come forward, Chief.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. And thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of this bill. I'm here today in my capacity as the Chief of the Mendota Heights Police Department, a legal gun owner, and someone who believes in the sanctity of life. I applaud Representative Holland's efforts to restrict the use of no-knock warrants. I don't pretend to understand all the negotiations that go into such an important topic, but I think she should be commended for crafting a bill in a way so it actually has a chance to get enacted into law, and for not letting perfection get in the way of progress. I tell anyone who will listen that my grandmother was a police officer, and she had the courage to speak up for what was right, even when it alienated her from her peers. She started in California in 1958, moved back to Minnesota in the early 60s, and she was a cop out at the airport for another 20 years. She saw a lot of changes over the course of her career, changes that cops swore up and down would be the end of policing as we know it. Changes like the Miranda decision and the Scales decision. But with each change, law enforcement rose to the challenge and found a way. She always said that the saddest thing in the world is wasted opportunity. We have an amazing opportunity before us today. We have the opportunity to reaffirm our commitment to the community safety. We have the opportunity to reaffirm our commitment to our citizens who legally exercise their Second Amendment right. And we have the opportunity to communicate to our cops on the street that their leadership will not put them in a position where their safety is compromised. We have the opportunity to take this bill further and fully ban the use of no-knock warrants. Banning no-knock warrants does not compromise community safety. Officers do not need a warrant to act when they are faced with in-progress crimes or matters of imminent safety. Banning no-knock warrants does not mean an end to forced entry on warrants. It just means that anyone present for those warrants has a reasonable opportunity to comply with the commands of the officers. Banning no-knock warrants does demonstrate to the community that we hear their concerns and we're committed to preserving human life. Our first line of defense, our officers, will also benefit from a complete ban of no-knock warrants. The officers executing warrants most often do not decide what warrants are served or how. They're likely following the orders of others in police leadership. While they are not the ones who decide to serve a no-knock warrant, they are the ones to pay a price when that warrant goes sideways. Banning no-knock warrants will show officers that their leadership will not intentionally create the chaotic conditions that can lead to tragedy, the type of conditions that led to the death of Amir Locke. I hear concerns that banning no-knock warrants will lead to officers leaving the profession. But the truth is, any law enforcement professional will tell you, the overwhelming majority of the warrants we serve are served via knock and announce. Nevertheless, if officers feel that disallowing the use of one rarely used tool is enough to leave the profession, then that's a failure of their leadership. It's our responsibility as CLIOs to train resilient and resourceful officers, like the officers that make up the vast majority of cops in our states. Advances in technology such as Ring doorbell systems can drastically negate any advantages that a no-knock warrant could provide, while underdoor camera systems could be used while knocking and announcing, getting eyes in the place to be searched before entry is ever made. Now is the time to make those investments in technology. You have an opportunity before you, the chance to amend this bill by banning the use of no-knock warrants. You have the opportunity to vote your values and to show your support for community safety, your support of legal gun owners, and your support of the police. You have the opportunity to completely ban no-knock warrants. It's your choice whether or not you waste that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Your mother's decision to come back to Minnesota decades ago produced a wonderful benefit to your community in Mendota. Mendota Heights, and to the people of Minnesota. Thank you for your testimony here today. We have four more testifiers, and then we'll open this up for comments and questions. And keep in mind, we still have amendments that we need to get through. First, we have Sheriff Tim Leslie, Dakota County Sheriff. You're always welcome here. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. It's Tim Leslie, Sheriff in Dakota County, and I'm fortunate to get to work with Kelly a lot, and just suffice to say we agree on a lot, but not everything. The Minnesota Sheriffs Association is who I'm testifying for. That's the 87 sheriffs in the state of Minnesota, and by and large, we agree that there are needs for change, and I think we want to work with the author to make those changes. We just prefer a little more of a surgical approach than a shotgun approach. And the two areas of concern for us are the training requirement. Remember that probably 85 of the 87 counties don't use no-knock warrants very often, and especially in those counties in rural Minnesota where they have never used them or have used one or two in the last 10 or 15 years. And so to make everyone subject to that training is a little bit much, considering all the training they're going to right now that's mandated by post, et cetera. So we would like a little different protections on that. And then the other one is the hostage circumstance that's outlined in the bill. We already have that exigent circumstance availability, so that can be modified as well. And I would happen to agree with Michelle Gross as well. Last resort, I think, is something we all could live with. So thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff. Look forward to working with you as this bill continues to move forward. Next, we have Chief Blair Anderson from St. Cloud. Chief, please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Blair Anderson. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of St. Cloud. I'm here representing several things, obviously my profession. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Chiefs Association. As you can see, I'm also a man of color, and I grew up in the most violent city, and I lived in the most violent precinct in this country, in Detroit, in the 60s and 70s. I am a staunch opponent of this bill, and my perspective comes from experience and as a practitioner. I was a SWAT operator for many years. I have been the point person, which means the first one to go through the door. And I've been on the business end of a firearm with someone with bad intentions. And when I read the language in this bill, one of the things that occurs to me is that there are perhaps members or supporters of this bill who have no idea what it is we're dealing with on the streets. We are not dealing with people who simply come to the door and answer it because we knock and ask them politely. Since July, when the new protocol went into place for us to have no-knock warrants signed at an administrative level before they are submitted for review and signature by a judge, we've executed 10 in the city of St. Cloud. There have been no injuries. There have been no killings. There have been no shootings. And all 10 people we were looking for have been taken into custody. And I'm going to tell you why. What has been left out of this conversation is that the standard to get any search warrant is high. And the standard to get a no-knock warrant is even higher. One of the things we use is a threat assessment. And we score before we ask for a no-knock warrant based on several things. Criminal history. The person that we're looking for is propensity for violence. Whether or not we can control that environment. Whether or not there are children present. And a whole host of other things that I won't bore you all with. My position is that if done properly with due diligence, this is the best and the safest option for us to resolve potentially volatile issues efficiently, effectively, and most importantly, peacefully. I can tell you the no-knock warrants we've applied for and gotten have all involved people who have been convicted of multiple felonies for violent crime. And I mean everything from armed robbery to aggravated assault to attempted murder. And so we are not dealing with people who are going to comply simply because we ask. We are dealing with people who have demonstrated over and over and over again that they will not comply, that they will not be civil, that they will use any means necessary to avoid capture by us. And I am asking this committee to be less impetuous and more sensible. The idea that if people leave this profession simply because we take this tool away, that that is a poor reflection on their leadership is something that I don't agree with. And I'll tell you why. The narrative that we've all witnessed in the last 2.5 years, going on 3 years, have driven many fine people from this profession for a variety of reasons. But one of them is they do not feel supported by their elected officials. And this is something I have heard over and over again when I have to conduct exit interviews. So I implore this committee to think long and hard about the language in this bill, and particularly, and Sheriff Leslie touched on this, the extreme circumstance is ironically similar to situations where we don't need a warrant of any kind. If I approach a dwelling and I have all of the information that's in this language that somebody is in imminent danger of death or bodily harm, I don't need a warrant of any kind, which makes that language superfluous to me. The training portion of this would make this the most trained aspect of our licensure. 16 hours a year is all that is required for any police officer across the board for all of the things that are mandated by the Pulse Board. That is not sustainable. And as Chief Leslie pointed to, for agencies in outstate Minnesota who don't have the resources, this becomes another unfunded mandate for them. And so I ask you all to consider how that is going to impact the profession. I cannot overemphasize enough that it is better for us to be able to have this tool and not use it than to be told that we can't use it at all. There are many no-knock warrants that we have applied for and received that we haven't executed in that manner. Another thing that hasn't been talked about are the tactics that are used. The threat assessment is one that we use. We have evolved from the days where we made dynamic entries and ran the walls and just flooded people with noise and lights and all kinds of stuff. Well, I can only speak for my agency, and the tactics that we use now involve surveillance. They involve gathering as much intelligence as possible before that warrant is executed. And when the warrant is executed, we use several tactics that heretofore I would not have revealed, but I think that we are at a critical point, and so I'm going to. We use tactics We use a breach and hold tactic where we breach the door and we hold that position to allow people time to process what is happening. We use a breach and limited penetration tactic. We use a breach and call out tactic. And all of those things are based on what it is we witness once we have entered that dwelling. And so, again, there needs to be some consideration for people that are on the front lines who go into these dangerous situations, and we do it willingly. And so what I will say in closing is simply this. Any of us would walk into freeway traffic for any of you without question. If that means that you will remain safe and you can get home to your loved ones. But what we won't do is be blindfolded and handcuffed and pushed into traffic. And that is how this makes me feel. As a practitioner, as someone who will gladly risk my life, and I have for 27 years, I implore you all to think about the impact that this is going to have. Before I close, I do want to send out my condolences to Amir Locke's family, and that is sincere. It is a tragedy. It is awful. And ours is one of the few professions where we can do everything right the way we were trained to do it and still have an awful outcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for your time. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chief. With that, we now have Julie Decker, and then followed by John Willis. And I would ask both of you to be as brief as possible. Ms. Decker, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've timed my testimony. It is approximately 1 minute. So, Mr. Chair and members, Julia Decker, I'm the Policy Director for the ACLU of Minnesota. We are glad that this committee is taking up the issue of no-knock warrants, and we appreciate Representative Hollins bringing HF 3398 forward. We understand that in the wake of Amir Locke's killing, this bill attempts to address some of the failures that led to his death, but we want to be clear that HF 3398 does not go far enough. The civil liberties implications of no-knock warrants demand that a ban on these types of warrants at least be on the table. And this committee and legislature need to confront what it means to maintain a system that finds it reasonable for the state to unilaterally authorize unannounced entrance by armed state agents into a person's residence and to have no mechanism for accountability when someone like Amir Locke is harmed or killed. So the ACLU of Minnesota wants to work with the legislature to pass laws that will meaningfully protect and realize the civil liberties of all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Decker. Appreciate your brevity and the strength of your testimony. Mr. Willis, Minneapolis resident, please come forward, sir, and please be as brief as possible.
Good afternoon, representatives. My name is John Willis, and I want to read. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Welcome. I want to read my thoughts on Bill HF 3398. First of all, thank you for allowing this time for testimony. I want to give my perspective on Bill HF 3398 as a resident of the Minneapolis community. I grew up in North Minneapolis, and my relationship with law enforcement has been a bit strained. I've appreciated law enforcement when they have stayed in the confines of their job, but I've also witnessed the terror that they have left in the wake of enforcing the law. The no-knock warrant has been used in Minnesota's law enforcement as a tool in the arsenal of terrorizing the community. I want to state that I'm not trying to introduce the idea that all law enforcement has purposely terrorized a targeted community, but the systemic effect of how operations are handled has indeed caused terror in the community in which I live. My ground zero of feeling terrorized comes from another case that's over 30 years old of a no-knock warrant gone horribly wrong with innocent casualties. It was Lillian Weiss and Lloyd Smalley, an elderly couple who died from smoke inhalation from a no-knock drug raid on their house. They had the wrong house. As a member in a targeted community, I often wonder if my house was going to be accidentally bulldozed or raided because of a bad tip, or if my kids would see their daddy laying face down on the sidewalk with my fingers laced above my head, forced into a stop and frisk when I came home from work. Growing up in an era of vice lords and disciples and general gang violence, my fear was never really my community, but with law enforcement. That's a pretty heavy statement that I don't say lightly. Looking towards the future for safety in my community, I'm excited that Minneapolis law enforcement has decided to do away with pretextual traffic stops for low-level offenses. It's time to do likewise and review what other tactics are being used that bring terror to my community. I can't see a situation where we don't preserve the dignity and respect for all people and no-knock warrants having a place in society, but I appreciate the extensive training that has been written into the bill and requirement of transparency needed to obtain a no-knock warrant. This brings my mind to some ease as I think about how in 30 years, we still have issues on the tactics that law enforcement use. I support HF 3398 as a good start in the right direction of protecting and serving my community. Thank you for your time, John Willis.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Willis. Appreciate you being with us. Members, we have 13 minutes because our wonderful staff has been able to negotiate an extra 10 minutes here. Here's what I'm going to propose. We have quite a few members that wish to comment and or ask questions. Obviously, if you're asking questions of witnesses, you want to be able to ask them now. There are also three amendments. If it is our desire to go through all that at this point, and I will remind members that the motion is to send this yet to another committee at Judiciary, so this is not the end of committee discussion, but it's certainly appropriate for us to spend the time that you want to spend. If that's the case, we will come back tomorrow morning to finish this bill. Let me at least begin with the First Amendment, then we'll move on to, if the amendments, we'll move on to questions and or comments that members wish to have. There is an A3 amendment. Is anyone offering the A3 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's my amendment.
Very well. Representative Leal moves the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So some of the concerns I have with this bill, and I do have to say that the chief from St. Cloud, wow, what a great explanation of no-knock warrants and how you use them appropriately. As always, I did my homework with this too and spent several hours at the Wright County Sheriff's Department talking to them about how they use no-knock warrants. And actually, that's a larger umbrella of things, as you know, that sometimes they go to the courts for a no-knock warrant and it's not an entry warrant. But that's a conversation for another day. But my concern is in the midst of doing an investigation, that investigatory information would remain private data. My concern is that just as the chief from St. Cloud said repeatedly, we're talking about people that are organized crime, very violent criminals. That's the subject of these warrants. And so the last thing I think any of us want is that a no-knock warrant information would become public while the investigation is still going on. That would be detrimental. So I think that the A3 fixes a gap in the bill that really would be detrimental to the investigation and putting organized crime and very, very violent criminals behind bars. So the A3 very simply just says that while the investigation is going on, that data would remain private. I think that is the best way to secure the case going forward and to make sure that evidence remains private so that organized crime and other violent criminals don't have their hands on it. And Mr. Chair, that was the amendment.
Very well. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. I think you're coming at this from the right direction, and I appreciate what you're trying to do. I am going to ask members to not support this amendment. Law enforcement can already wait 90 days to report the information, and because this bill would limit it to a really narrow set of circumstances where no-knock warrants are even being used, I would assume that we wouldn't need to have that particular protection in place. So I would ask for our members to not support this amendment. Thank you.
Chair Mariani, I request the roll call on this.
A roll call has been requested and shall be taken. The clerk will take the roll on the amendment.
Chair Mariani?
No.
Chair Mariani, nay. Vice Chair Frazier?
No.
Vice Chair Frazier, nay. Lee Johnson?
Yes.
Lee Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson?
No.
Representative Edelson, nay. Representative Feist?
No.
Representative Feist, nay. Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, aye. Representative Hollins?
No.
Representative Hollins, nay. Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Hewitt, nay. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, no.
Representative Cleavorn, nay. Representative Long?
No.
Representative Long, nay. Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Pinto, nay. Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
Vang, no.
Representative Vang, nay. Representative Xiong?
Xiong, no.
And that concludes roll call with 8 ayes and 11 nays.
With 8 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail and the A3 amendment is not added. There is an A4 amendment. Is anyone offering the A4 amendment?
Chair Mariani, that would be my amendment.
Very well. Representative Johnson moves adoption of the A4 amendment. Representative Johnson, to your amendment.
The A4 amendment is quite simple. It changes the Attorney General, who does not actually have any authority under the current statutes unless asked to assist in criminal investigations, to change it to the County Attorney, who is the sole authority on criminal prosecution in the state of Minnesota for each county. And since the County Attorney is the one responsible, it changes the training from the Attorney General to the County Attorney, because they're the ones who actually works with the officers, has to defend those search warrants, and a lot of times assists in making sure that the search warrants are correct when they are in some areas of the state. But also on line 6, it inserts after officers to employed by the law enforcement agency located inside the county. Because the county attorney is doing that, he should be working with the officers that he does the prosecutions for and works with on a regular basis.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I would ask our members to not support this. The goal of this language is to have a unified structure that we're doing things under and have a training that is consistent across all counties and cities. And that's why it's written that way. So please do not support this amendment. Thank you.
Roll call will be requested.
Representative Johnson requests a roll call, and a roll call shall be taken. The clerk will take the roll on the motion.
Chair Mariani?
No.
Chair Mariani, nay. Vice Chair Frazier?
No.
Vice Chair Frazier, nay. Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson?
Nay.
Representative Edelson, nay. Representative Feist?
Nay.
Representative Feist, nay. Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, aye. Representative Hollins?
Nay.
Representative Hollins, nay. Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Hewitt, nay. Representative Cleavorn?
No.
Representative Cleavorn, nay. Representative Long?
No.
Representative Long, nay. Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Pinto, nay. Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
No.
Representative Vang, nay. Representative Xiong?
No.
Representative Xiong, nay. With 8 ayes and 11 nays. That concludes roll call.
With 8 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail and the A4 amendment is not added to the bill. There is finally an A5 amendment. Is anyone offering the A5 amendment?
That'll be me, Chair.
Very well. Representative Otney moves adoption of the A5 amendment. Representative Otney.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. A5 is strictly changing of a couple words to go from to strike clear and convincing evidence for the threshold to bring the bill in line with state law, which is that probable cause be the basis for the granting of a affidavit for a search warrant.
Very well. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. I would recommend that our members vote no on this. Clear and convincing evidence is a significantly higher burden of proof than probable cause, and our goal is to make sure that these are used in the slimmest of circumstances. Thank you.
Roll call requested.
Very well. Representative Johnson requests a roll call, and a roll call shall be taken. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
No.
Nay. Chair Mariani, nay. Vice Chair Frazier?
No.
Vice Chair Frazier, nay. Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson?
No.
Representative Edelson, nay. Representative Feist?
No.
Representative Feist, nay. Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, aye. Representative Hollins?
No.
Representative Hollins, nay. Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Hewitt, nay. Representative Cleavorn?
No.
Representative Cleavorn, nay. Representative Long?
No.
Representative Long, nay. Representative Lucero?
Lucero, yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Pinto, nay. Representative Poston?
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
Vang, no.
Representative Vang, nay. Representative Shung?
Shung, no.
Representative Shung, nay. And that concludes roll with 8 ayes and 11 nays.
Very well. With 8 ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail, and the A5 amendment is not added to the bill. Members, that concludes the amendments. I don't see any other here. We do have several members. I will work very diligently to get us through this while I get in deep hot water with IT. I think I'd rather get in trouble with the speaker than with IT, but there you go. So let's begin. You know, Representative Novotny, I see your hand up, and I'm not sure if that was from before or not, but I would certainly call on you if you wish to comment or ask a question of any type.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. It was up from before, but more than happy to. It would have been up for this one anyway.
So. Oh, well, there you go.
Yes. I'll have a question for the author when I'm done here, and I'll be as brief as I can.
Please. Thank you.
Representative Hollins pointed out that she thinks that there's blood on all of her hands because this wasn't addressed last year. And I probably made reference to this before, but last summer when I asked for extra funding to bring extra patrols into high crime area in the metropolitan area to try to interrupt the exploding, and at that time we thought it was as bad as it could get, but then it got worse for the crime rate, the violence, crime. It's unbelievable. It's indescribable what it has become. And when I tried to get funding for that, Governor Walz described my plan as simplistic, that bringing in extra help wouldn't make a difference, only to find out this week that he's bringing in 10 days of a saturation with the state patrol, doing exactly what we proposed last summer. And during that news conference, when we brought this forward,
there was a question from one of the reporters about how do we improve police and community relations. And I said, we improve police community relations when we don't have the constant need for police officers to try to solve murders. One of the most volatile calls that you can go on as a police officer is to try to apprehend someone that has been involved in a murder. You're doing a murder investigation. Think about that. This is the state of Minnesota where everything runs concurrent. If you've already killed someone, you have nothing to lose by killing someone else. You'll serve the terms concurrent. And as I said last summer, if we had less murder investigations to do, we would have less volatile contact between the community and the police. So do we have blood on our hands? Yes. This murder investigation that they were conducting was a murder that took place in St. Paul. And I don't know all the particulars of it, but it's most likely, as we've seen in the past with the gang murders, it's a gang murder to retaliate for a previous gang murder, to retaliate for a previous gang murder. Which at any point, if there would have been an arrest, somebody would have been in jail and they wouldn't have been available to be, you know, have retribution brought upon them. The day before Amir Locke was shot, a no-knock search warrant was used to make the arrest of the people in the Rice killing at the Richfield High School. We've seen that over 100 search warrants were executed in Minneapolis with no-knock search warrants in the previous year. Is that racially disparate? Probably. You know what else is racially disparate? The number of murder victims. If we take the Minneapolis numbers alone, almost 100, right in the 100 range last year, that is more than the rest of the state put together, including St. Paul, which was also at record highs. Of course, there will be disparity when it follows the victimology. The victims are racially disparate. Going down to my point for Ms. Groh, she brought up the fact, and she cited my exact concern that we're expressing here and that Chief Anderson had. The police knocked on the door and they took rounds through the door. So thank you, Lee Johnson, for asking for roll calls on all these things. I will be asking for a roll call when we come up to the final vote for this, because I want people to know who voted on this. Chief McCarty, I saw a press interview that she did. She was talking about how you can have body bunkers at the door and do the call out, the knock and announce. But what Chief McCarty doesn't tell you is those body bunkers are only pistol rated. Pistol round will go right through it. So I want the names on the roll call because I want to know who's going to be answering for the blood on their hands of the officers when we know the situation like Ms. Gross described is going to result in somebody taking rounds through the door.
Representative Navani, there will be a roll call on the bill. That's absolutely appropriate. I would ask you to, however, unless we all come back tomorrow morning.
I'll be available, okay. Chair Mariani. I'll wrap here.
Thank you, sir.
I was hoping to have Mr. Doerr available for questioning. I know Mr. Doerr does concealed carry classes. If he could be available tomorrow, I'd like to follow up with him asking about what they teach people with concealed carry permits about their rights and responsibilities when they are carrying a firearm. Been 10 years since I did concealed carry classes, and I know what I told the students when they were carrying a gun about if they have extra responsibilities or rights when they carry that gun. So I'd like to ask Mr. Doerr about that. With that, as I said, Chair Mariani, thank you for letting me expound here, but we'll be back tomorrow.
Appreciate it, Representative, your comments, not the hope that we'd be back tomorrow. With that, Representative Long?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're over time, I'm happy to defer to my colleagues. On Judiciary Committee.
Oh, my apologies to you. Representative Pinto.
So there we go. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I guess I just want to remind us that these no-knock warrants are not being used in, I think, in most of the agencies around the state. And we're talking about agencies that have crime in their communities. In fact, I feel like we've heard from our colleagues in the minority that St. Paul is a community that is experiencing, in their view, as they've been talking about this, increased levels of crime. And the police force that I work with as a prosecutor does not use no-knock warrants. I think has a couple times in 2016, only when another agency demands it, as it seems like was the case in the killing of Muir Locke. I've not been on the scene myself, and respect my colleagues who have, and of course the officers who have, but I have read many reports and seen in many body camera videos of the steps that officers take to keep themselves and others safe in terms of, in some situations, breaching a door, calling people out. Of course, if you have a situation where there's something unsafe happening inside the house at that moment, Representative Hollins's bill reflects that, and officers then go in. But I want to recognize that there are communities that are taking the kind of steps we heard from the chief in St. Cloud, dealing with some dangerous people and doing so in a way where no-knock warrants are not necessary. And it has been years since they've been used in these communities. So we know that is possible. It's more than possible. It's in fact something that is happening right now. And so it's simply a statement by the legislature saying, look, we want all agencies in the state to live up to those standards and those approaches taken by the many agencies that are not using this, except in the most limited of circumstances as described in the bill. So I just kind of want to remind us is we're not taking away a tool that leaves officers exposed. Most of the officers in the state are not using this tool in their agencies as well. We're simply expecting other agencies to then follow that same approach. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I've got a series of questions, and some of them are pretty technical. They will require some of the testifiers and the author, and I'm wondering at this point at 2:48 if we should move until a meeting till tomorrow. I don't believe that I'll be satisfied with just 2 minutes of being able to ask questions, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we do what we can and let's see where that takes us, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question is, Representative Hollins stated that if this bill was in place, you said that Muir Locke would not be dead. I don't want to make a mischaracterization. So my first question is that what you said? My follow-up to that question is, if that's true, how specifically would this bill have changed the progression towards the no-knock warrant? The progression into the apartment, and then the events leading up specifically to the shooting, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Raleigh. Yes, that is exactly what I mean, that this bill would have prevented the loss of Muir Locke's life, and that is because this bill is narrowly tailored to be in a situation where there is currently harm happening in the residence where the no-knock warrant is being executed. That was never asserted in the warrant application that was presented to Judge Cahill, and therefore the no-knock warrant would not have been requested and would not have been granted, and therefore we would not be in this situation that we're in.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you. And so using that exact same logic, if we were following the strict interpretation of this new law, and they did receive a no-knock warrant, would the situation have progressed the same way? And that's why I broke it up into the three steps.
Representative Hollins.
They wouldn't have received a no-knock warrant because it doesn't meet the criteria enumerated in the bill.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I must not have said it correctly. If they did obtain a no-knock warrant underneath the specific narrow guidelines of this bill, and they did execute that no-knock warrant underneath the specific parameters of this bill, would that have prevented this tragedy?
I believe that Representative Raleigh, what Representative Hollins is saying, is that the circumstances of the Locke case precisely does not necessitate a no-knock warrant. I think you're asking a much broader question, not necessarily about Mr. Locke, but in another instance. So I just want to be clear about that. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Raleigh. I think this is where, in your hypothetical situation in which there might be granted a no-knock warrant in a situation that this bill would not normally allow it, our goal would be that the additional training that we've put in place here would helpfully, make it a situation in which somebody is not killed unnecessarily. An innocent life is not lost.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It states on 2.23 that a no-knock warrant shall not be issued when a police officer applying for a warrant has prior knowledge of the subject or household member's disability within the meaning of the United States Code, Title 42, 12102. The two questions I've got on that are, why was that particular code used? And then it goes, I did review that USC code, and if I could, there is a series of disabilities that are listed, including major life activities that are not limited to seeing, hearing, eating, sleeping, walking, standing, lifting, bending, speaking, breathing, learning, reading, concentrating, thinking, communicating, and working. And so, Mr. Chair, the reason for the question is, why was that particular definition chosen, and how would those disabilities affect a future lawsuit against a police officer, should that police officer know that a person had a speaking disability, and then a no-knock warrant was issued, and then later on it was proven that the police officer knew about this disability? How would that affect both the issuance of that no-knock warrant, and then does that not open up the police officer for additional liability? Mr. Chair?
Representative Raleigh, I suspect you will have wandered beyond the scope of this bill when we're talking about liabilities, but I will allow Representative Hollins to issue a brief response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Raleigh. That is quite the hypothetical. And what I will say about it is this is a situation where they knowingly do something, and if it is banned in the bill, then we say that that information that's provided would put them in a situation where if they included it in the application, it would not be granted. And if it was not included in the application, then they would be in trouble pursuant to the portion below that, knowingly giving false information or incorrect information. So I think that would cover it. And the language, that particular statute was chosen by House Research. I believe it is the Americans with Disability Act.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Raleigh, I've given you a lot of latitude. It is not the intention of this chair to have that latitude, quite frankly, be abused. I'm not accusing you of that, but I certainly do not intend to turn this into a 10-hour hearing with endless questions. So if you could please sum up your questions before us. This is absolutely within custom and usage of this House. Our committees do not run on endlessly. Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really thought that I was reading from the statute here, United States Code, Title 42, Section 12102, and then asking the question specifically about liability of police officers. I apologize, Mr. Chair, if you feel that I went off of the latitude that you've given me, but specifically I was asking about how this law, implemented the way that it is, would affect a future case.
Representative Raleigh, your questions are absolutely appropriate. And so
thank
if I
you,
indicated that they're not, I apologize for that. My only point here is that it is not custom and usage to have individuals ask endless questions. And so I'm just giving you an alert to that. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would renew my request that we do continue tomorrow. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I'm looking at the bill, and I'm looking at, some of the listening to the testimony. And I just want to tell both Sheriff Leslie and Chief Anderson, thank you for your testimony, especially Chief Anderson, having been a person like myself, who was on the front end of a lot of SWAT call stacks, who did enter through those doors first. And I have an experience in preparing no-knock warrants and knock and announce warrants. And in my time in law enforcement, they all held up in court. Yes, because you know, each one of these things you take before a judge to have it scrutinized to make sure that the probable cause is there, be issued in your application. And you know, the judges that I dealt with, they would not allow an unjustified knock and announce or an unannounced search warrant to be issued unless you met the criteria that was needed, unless all four corners of that warrant were in place. And as a rule, I would always take it to the toughest judge to make sure that it was scrutinized very well, because like any other officer out there, you're going to legally breach someone's home. You're going to legally breach someone's home. And the last thing you want to do is do it out of step and violate someone's rights. Never want to do that. So I guess I would look at this bill and the way it's written right now, that the police who used a no-knock warrant to apprehend Jamar Rice's murderers would not have been able to execute a no-knock warrant. And that's if I'm understanding that correctly. Representative Hollins, not seeing that correctly, would you please, under your bill, would the officers have been able to get a no-knock warrant to apprehend the murderers of Jamari Rice?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Grossel. I'm sorry, I don't know the ins and outs of that case well enough to opine on whether or not that would happen. I apologize.
Representative Grossel.
And the way it is written, no, they would not have been able to receive an unannounced search warrant to apprehend those murder suspects. And that's exactly what Chief Anderson was talking about. A tool, and I hear this from county attorneys all the time, don't take away a tool that we might not use all the time, but a tool that is needed to complete our toolbox. This is a tool that law enforcement needs. And to make it so difficult to get access to a needed tool is not wise. It is just not wise. And I see Representative Pinto shaking his head a little bit there, but that's okay. That's okay, because it was Representative Pinto that gave me that counsel at one time.
I can't believe that Representative Pinto is shaking your head at your comment.
I would like to ask, you know, you have, why is the Attorney General and not the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board tasked with training the peace officers on the use of warrants, including no-knocks?
Representative Hollins.
Yeah, that's a really fair question. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Grossel. We were advised that in this situation, the post board would not be the one who would design a training, but would instead implement it. And that if we wanted somebody who would be statewide to do it, it would be the Attorney General. And that advice was given to us by nonpartisan research.
Representative Grossel.
Well, right now, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins, Minnesota BCA does a lot of that training. They have since I was a deputy sheriff, and they continue to. And they make the adjustments with the differences and the changes over the years. And it is very, very good and thorough training. I don't think that you would want the Attorney General giving that type of training, because the Attorney General does not execute or use those warrants on a regular basis, but the Minnesota BCA does. The Minnesota BCA does, and so they They know what they're doing. They have excellent training for all of the police departments and sheriff's offices around the state. And I would think, you may want to take another look at your legislation right now, because to take it out of the hands of the Minnesota BCA would be a mistake. And like I said, I received that training there. And again, all of my warrants stood up to all the scrutiny in court and even before it was executed. So I guess, you hear from the law enforcement community that this is something that is needed. And with the violent crime that has increased so exponentially in this state, and especially in our metro areas, to hinder your law enforcement from being able to do their job and to make sure that they can execute search warrants safely, it is not a wise thing to do at all. Mr. Chair, I'll leave it to Representative Johnson or whoever's next after that. I hope Representative Hollins, that you'll take a step back because if heaven forbid, one of us on this committee or one of our family members is victimized by this violent crime increase in this state, that officers would have every tool accessible to them to make sure that they apprehend those who committed crimes against us or our family members.
Thank you, Representative Grasso. You certainly have given us important things to think about. I appreciate that. Representative Johnson, the chair will intend to act on this bill in the next 5 minutes, but you have the last word, other than the author of the bill. But Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Hollins. I understand what this bill is about and why it was brought forward. Unfortunately, I believe it's the wrong approach. There's many places that we can go, but one area I have a question for Representative Hollins on. Representative Hollins, do you know the number of hours required for licensing for a peace officer at this time?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. I've heard two different numbers that were being told to me, so I'm not sure which one is correct, but I would love for you to inform me.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Hollins, that I don't know if you know the answer or not. I do. It's 48 hours. Our current licensing is 48 hours every 3 years. Depending on your license cycle, we mandate between 42 and 50 hours. If you fall in there's 1 year during that 3 year time period, you could actually be required to do 2 more hours of mandated training than required to get your license. And in your bill, you actually require in the 3 year time period, just 48 hours of training on a search warrant that in most parts of the state are used maybe 1-2 times a year. That is, I'm not even gonna go there. Like I said, there's lots of issues with this bill, from the training to the who's putting the training together and who's doing the training. If you read the bill, it's not Post Board doing the training. It's the Attorney General's office doing the training, who has actually, by state statute, unless asked by a county attorney for assistance, has no authority in criminal cases to put together search warrants for and training on criminal cases, where the county attorney actually does that work and actually does the prosecution of them. They want to make sure their search warrants are done properly and correctly. And guess what? We actually do have county attorneys that do training on search warrants already. I've been to a couple of them myself. in my career in law enforcement officer. Also, I want to thank Chief Anderson. I too have been the first one in the door on both knock and announce and no knock warrants. I remember one no knock warrant we had. Instead of bashing the door in, I checked. The door was unlocked. We went in. We all got lined up. The suspects were wearing their firearms, and one of them actually had the rifle in his hand when we yelled, "Police, drop your weapons." If we had kicked the door in, they'd have been shooting at us. We were fortunate. The door was unlocked. We were able to get in and resolve it in a safe manner. There's a reason we have them. They're generally in greater Minnesota, most places across the state, they're not abused. There's policy, every department has a policy in place. The courts require certain criteria to even consider a no-knock warrant. And they make sure that we have all our I's dotted and our T's crossed. Written a number of search warrants, both no knock and knock and announce. And guess what? I've had both declined at times. I had to go get more information for the judge. Sometimes I'm able to get that information, sometimes I'm not. But as a Representative Grassl stated, it's an important tool in the toolbox. Speaking of the toolbox, I remember a vehicle I was working on the other day.
Representative Johnson,
this goes into how
we do want to get to a voter.
I agree. But what the vehicle I was working on, I need a specific tool that I had not used in 10 years, but it was in my toolbox. Because I had it, I was able to get that job done in my son's vehicle so he could go to school. Do not take tools away that are used properly. Maybe we should look at the policies that Minneapolis Police Department had in place to obtain a no-knock warrant. I know my department I work, they're very specific. In fact, its current application on search warrants has that specific stuff in it to show why it is needed. There's a specific line on the search warrants already. This bill is not fit for prime time. I believe this bill is, in fact, well, I'm not going to say what I was going to say. I just say vote no on this thing and get it done with.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Hollins, you get the final word here, and then we're going to move to action on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, everybody on the committee, for your time and consideration of this incredibly important piece of legislation. We've heard a lot about training and about the AG versus the BCA, about gang violence and who uses what kind of warrants. But the long and the short of it is, we need to make sure that we don't lose any more lives to no-knock warrants. And that's what this bill aims to do. This is not only an opportunity for our redemption as lawmakers, but it's an opportunity for law enforcement to repair the relationship with the community by not actively imposing legislation that the public is asking for. We have grieving families who want to see this legislation done. I know Amir Locke's family was at the funeral watching this hearing because it is so important to them that we make change. I would ask you to please support this effort. Do it for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. I do want to thank all the testifiers here today, our chiefs, our sheriffs, our community members, our advocates, and of course, our stellar committee members for today's conversation and debate. With that, Representative Hollins renews her motion that House File 3398 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Chair Mariani? Aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier? Aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Johnson? Nay. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt? Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Hewitt, nay. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No blood on my hands and no to this bill.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, nay. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, nay. Representative O'Neill?
No.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang?
Vang, aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Shung?
Shung, aye.
Representative Shung, aye. And that concludes roll call with 10 ayes and 9 nays.
Very well. With 10 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does prevail. And House File 3398 is referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Members, thank you for the hearing today. Thank you to IT. Please enjoy tomorrow morning. We won't be in committee, but I know all of you are going to be working awfully hard on legislation tomorrow, so hopefully you'll have the time to do that. With that, members, until next week, this committee stands adjourned.